Milwaukee and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on the Civic Media app.
This is a special report from ABC News, the Democratic National Convention. I'm Chuck Sievertson.
Let us always remember when we fight, we win. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
A surprise appearance by Vice President Kamala Harris to cheer on fellow Democrats and thank President Biden, as did the Democrats' first woman nominee for president.
He brought dignity, decency, and competence back to the White House.
Hillary Clinton also talking about this.
Donald Trump fell asleep at his own trial, and when he woke up, he made his own kind of history, the first person to run for president with 34 felony convictions.
Outside the convention, several arrests of protesters who broke through an outer security barrier. This is ABC News.
This is your local Civic Media radio station. Want to hear even more? Anytime? Find all of it at civicmedia.us.
Tome Olson. Here's what Wisconsin needs to know. The four men accused of killing Devontae Mitchell outside a Milwaukee hotel will stand trial for murder. According to the criminal complaint, two security guards, a bellhop, and a front desk worker pinned Mitchell to the ground in June. They're each charged with being party to a felony murder and could face up to 15 years and 9 months in prison. In a hearing Monday, all four were bound over for trial. They're expected to enter pleas on Thursday. And Vice President Kamala Harris and Governor Tim Walz are headed to Wisconsin Tuesday. They'll host a rally at Fiserv Forum. These rallies have become big, energetic events, so you can expect a lot of people in the Deer District area. Walz at the Democratic National Convention Monday.
Just came from the Wisconsin breakfast, and the blue wall is solid, people. The blue wall is solid.
Civic Media will have special coverage all week from Chicago. And that's what you need to know. I'm Savannah Tome Olson, and this is Civic Media News.
The Democratic National Convention is in Chicago, and our team will be there to tell you what you need to know. I'm Civic Media News Director Terry Bell.
And I'm Todd Allball, host of The Todd Allball Show. Count on us for important analysis, interviews, and the Democrats' nomination of their presidential candidate.
Live from the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. Listen for updates, plus special coverage at 6 each night. Find it on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app. News from the Center, WRCE.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here today on the big program. Lots to get to. Lots to talk about. How many people remember the Obamacare fight? How many people remember going back to the days of the Obamacare duking it out? And understand, a lot of what the Affordable Care Act was, conservative ideology being lessened a little bit. It was the Heritage Foundation's, basically their plan from the early 90s, that ended up getting a lot of attention in here. The idea of personal responsibility, the individual mandate, which then Republicans used as a massive divisive tool, even though their idea, and a lot of this stuff that were meant to so-called cut costs. And look, I completely agree with the personal responsibility idea. Everybody has to be in. In order for a giant pool, an insurance pool to work, you need more people in to mitigate risk. This way, the fewer people are getting benefits out or getting claims paid, more people are paying in, helps the pot grow, gives security to a lot more people. It's a smart idea, and I'm all on board. But there was one thing that even I said, I'm not overly thrilled with. And it was the idea of a Cadillac tax. You may remember this. The idea was they were going to tax healthcare plans that were above a certain number. Me as a union member, we negotiate a lot for generous benefits. We want good, the best. We want Cadillac healthcare. And I give you an example. When I had my hip replaced back in 2019, it cost me like $120 out of pocket. That's the hospital, the doctor, the therapy. That's everything. That's unheard of in this day and age. Now, look, I pay for it. I pay for it mightily in yearly premiums. And what the Affordable Care Act had put forth was this idea that they were going to tax these plans. And if I remember the number at the time, it was $25,000. So if your health care costs for a family was over $25,000, I think it was like $11,000 or something like that for an individual, or was it maybe $18,000? But you would have to pay tax on that bit above what the allotment was. And the idea was on these Cadillac plans was to tax them a 40% excise tax on the part of the employer-sponsored health insurance premiums above that dollar mark. The thought was a couple of things could happen, that people would maybe not have these really, really generous benefits, that the idea is that I have and I'm going to use just because I have it. I go to the doctor only when it's absolutely necessary, and then it has to be absolutely necessary. But it's interesting to me that Project 2025 has reignited this a little bit. Now, remember, you go back to the Obamacare years. You had John Boehner criticizing it because it would have an impact on workers and employers. You had Paul Ryan against it because it would increase the cost of families. You had Mitch McConnell, who cared. It was going to harm middle-class families. Lindsey Graham was worried about burdening those who had high-cost plans. Ron Johnson, he said it was going to lead to reduced benefits. Marco Rubio, this is detrimental to workers' health care coverage because we care so much. Rick Santorum made it one of his central themes of his presidential campaign, his failed presidential campaign. So you have these well-noted Republicans, a party dead set against it. Now understand, they were dead set against it. Why? Well, because it was Obama's name on it. Anything in there, even though they were all their ideas, anything in there was bad because Obama did it. That's the kind of knee-jerk reaction our politics have become. So now we now have this idea that there's the Cadillac plan. They fought against it, killed it off. But now Project 2025 has revived it. It's back. Only now it's going to be, they're saying, $11,200 or $30,000 per family. So $11,000 per person, $30,000. Or it's $12,000 annually per worker. And then I think $30,000 above that. So it's back. And what's going to happen potentially is either employers are going to give workers higher wages and fewer benefits. That's the kind of the hope. Or what we know is going to happen. They're just going to cut benefits. And the workers are going to shoulder more of the burden coming out of this. And we already know that's going to be the kind of thought that's going to happen, because we've seen it play out in other places, haven't we? Now you go, but Rick, you know, that sounds new. No, this was in the Republican Study Committee's proposal as well. This is a long-standing ideological fight for the right. As I've said a million times, there's nothing really new in this plan. It's that they've put it all together, the hat trick of horrible, the handbag of horrible, right here in one document. So if you want to see what they want to do to your healthcare benefits, it's page 7, by the way, if you're reading along at home. So for me, well worth potentially thinking about, because they're telling us again, they want to tax your benefits. Instead of saying, how do we get more affordable benefits so that we don't have to have these high cost plans? They just want to tax them. I got to tell you, $12,000 a year for health insurance doesn't sound like a lot of money. I want to hear your thoughts. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. I'm going to take a quick break. Right back with more of the handbag of horrible.
We We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So for the last couple of months, we've been talking about this Project 2025, which now, look, is the Republican platform. This is what they want to do. This is in extreme detail, 900 and some pages of horrible and how they want to change this country. Everything from eliminating Head Start and the Department of Education and Environmental Protection to, well, getting rid of overtime protections and ending collective bargaining rights and basically repealing the 20th century. The question becomes, how do we educate union members especially and working people on how bad this actually is, which is why I've asked Jody Callahan to come talk with us. Jody is the AFL-CIO's Director of Advocacy. Jody, thanks for taking time for us.
I'm happy to be here.
So, look, you know, we kind of laid out a little bit of what this Project 2025 is. From your perspective, how bad is this for working people?
It is devastating for working people. It is a blueprint, and I think for what will happen if Trump were to retake the White House. And I want to be very clear about this. This is the real deal. This is what they intend to do. I know Trump is trying to run away from it as fast as he can. The reality is it was written by at least 140 of his former administration officials, ranging from cabinet secretaries to a White House chief of staff and so forth, or a personnel director in the White House. It is people who were in the Trump administration the first go around and will expect to be in it the next go around. And they realized that when he took office back in 2017, he wasn't ready to be president. He handled the whole operation very incompetently from their perspective. And so this go around, they want to make sure they do things the right way and have an orderly implementation of their agenda. And that's why they spent more than 900 pages detailing that agenda and what needs to happen. So this is the real deal. And if Trump takes office, these are the things we will see. And it's not just the changes in regulations and so forth. It is a reimagining of our working lives.
No, it's a fundamental shift of what America is. This is, like I said, repealing the 20th century. But, you know, the arrogance of putting this down in paper, the arrogance of talking about it in public, because, look, these ideas, I'm sure you know this as well as anyone, there's nothing in this 900-plus page document that's really new. This stuff's been banging around in these right-wing think tanks for at least a generation. It's just now they finally see someone in Trump who's willing to move that agenda or allow them to use government in a way to move that agenda.
I would say there is a little bit of newness to this. You're right that there is a ton of stuff in here we've seen a million times before over the last few decades. It is a wish list of anti-union, anti-worker organizations when it comes to things like eliminating health and safety rules or getting rid of overtime pay. That's all in there, and we've seen that many times before. But there's a lot more when you take a step back and take a look at the entire picture here. There's even more nefarious things going on. The way in which they attack civil rights and undermine the civil rights enforcement and then take Title VII inside, which is enforced by EEOC, and turn it on its head so that it will go after things like diversity, equity, and inclusion programs in workplaces. These are new things that are coming from a very extreme far right vision for what America should look like. So what we have is them plowing the ground by making workers desperate and more insecure, by getting rid or doing things that will lower wages and benefits and rights in the workplace, and then divide the workplace, divide the workforce. By going after people's civil rights and doing things to make sure everyday racism and sexism is alive and well in the workplace. So you now have a divided workforce and a very sort of insecure workforce.
Yeah.
And beyond that, though, then they go after unions in a particular fashion, which is extraordinary. When you piece it all together,
you're going through all these things, and in my mind I'm going, yeah, this is stuff that they've been wanting to do for 100 years now. They want to repeal the 20th century and move us back to the good old days of the 80s and 90s, and not the 1980s and 90s. This is the Jay Gould. I can pay half the working class to murder the other half. This isn't new, but it's just a new tactic and a new way of going about it. And sadly, one that some portion of the American people seem to be a little bit okay with.
Well, when you piece it together, this is what I'm starting to see, is that they, on top of what I just mentioned, they want to eliminate public sector unions altogether, which isn't new. You're right. When it comes to private sector unions, they want to explicitly weaken them. And then replace them with company-controlled unions, so that within the private sector, there may still be some version of a union, but it's more like a club that does what the boss wants. So those would still exist. And then the employers that they will privilege are religious employers, and they will give religious employers the ability to trump any rights you might have. So a worker would have to conform to the boss's religious views if they want a job or want to keep a job or get a promotion and so forth. So there's this vision of a very insecure, divided workforce in this country with less rights, less pay, less benefits, reliance upon religious employers who will dictate how one should live, and clubs of private sector workers who will probably be some sort of power center supporting this right-wing vision. No public sector unions, and therefore no check on government power, which, you know, public sector unions are our whistleblowers when they see things going wrong in the government. So it's important that public sector workers have a voice if we want to have a democracy.
Yeah.
It is a vision that is not America. It is something else.
Well, I would argue it's the America of 100 years ago. It's the benevolent dictator that Henry Ford was. It's the patronage government of the past that, you know, be loyal to the top of the ticket and maybe you'll get a job, and having those wide swings, which when you break this down for average voters, and I've had a number of these personal conversations, nobody seems to think, when you're talking to them individually, that this is a great idea. No one thinks that returning to these horrible policies of the past and putting them into one giant weaponized package, no one seems to think that that's a great idea. So you guys at the AFL-CIO, I'm sure you're out knocking on doors. I'm sure you're out talking to people across the country. Are you getting the same kind of sense, the same kind of reaction back, that the more people learn about this Project 2025, the more that they're going to repel it?
Yes, it is deeply unpopular among any part of the American population, but especially among workers who understand what their rights are and how hard it was to win these rights that we have today. I think the key is for working people to understand how it will affect their bottom line. And I'd love to give you an example of how it will affect a union member's bottom line, which is, one of the provisions or the proposals in this Project 2025 is that they want to make federal employment laws negotiable at the bargaining table. In other words, we have a minimum wage, you know, set by the federal government, by federal law. We have health and safety regulations. They want to say that you can negotiate out from underneath those things at the bargaining table. So let's say everybody who's a union member listening to your show right now, we all have a contract coming up at some point. We all have a hope that in that contract negotiation, we will get a 10% raise or whatever raise we're aiming for. When you show up to bargaining under Project 2025, the employer could say, as their opening wage proposal, we are going to pay you 10 cents an hour and not pay you any overtime. That's our opening proposal. Bargain up from that. And so union members, unions will have to fight like crazy to just get back up to the minimum wage.
Yeah.
You know, forget that raise you were hoping for. This is all designed to make union contracts less generous and cut wages and benefits because they want to replace them with, oh, look over here, there's a company union that you can belong to and be a part of that will not negotiate with the employer.
Or as I've been calling them,
your voice and your interests at heart.
Yeah, as I've been calling them,
they're gunning for
suggestion box unions. But you know, you make an interesting point on the negotiation side, and I don't think a lot of people. I know a lot of my union friends think that they're going to be okay. That, you know, hey, my union's been doing this all along. It's all hyperbole. My union's fighting for me. We got a good contract last time around. I can now have the luxury of voting on other issues, be it guns or abortion or same-sex marriage or who uses what bathroom or whatever divisive issue they throw out at us. Is this a moment where maybe working people should start going back to where my grandparents were? And it's you vote your job, you vote your paycheck, you vote what puts a roof over your head and clothes on your kids' back. Is this that kind of moment?
Absolutely. I think it was Walter Reuther who said what we win at the bargaining table can be lost at the ballot box. And this is a prime example of that rule, which is they want to empower employers to bust their unions. There was the proposal I just mentioned about bargaining from like 10 cents an hour and being able to put what today would be an illegal wage proposal on the table from an employer. There's also a proposal that says that gets rid of the contract bar under the NLRA. And what that means is in the middle of your contract, an employer could bust your union, push and encourage in the ways that they do, employees to decertify your union. And at that moment, in the middle of your contract, you lose your contract. You lose your union wages, your benefits, and your protections in one fell swoop. It's all about busting unions, all about making sure union contracts are less and less generous.
Well, I'm sure you just saw the other day in the what was one of the most bizarre interviews I've ever heard, Elon Musk and Donald Trump, you know, stammering and stuttering over each other to figure out who's going to stick whose head up, which other person's behind. The little gem came out that, from Donald Trump saying that, Elon is the greatest cost cutter. You know, when those workers went on strike, you went in and fired them all gone. For me, that should be playing on a loop in every unionized workplace. That alone should be that thing that says Trump is a vote for Trump is something that a working person should never entertain because of that statement right there.
Yep. Donald Trump is no friend of workers. I think he got comfortable in that interview and was going on and on and on. It was an amazing period of time in which you're listening to two men who knew nothing about what they were talking about, but felt like they had an opinion that they needed to share on every single subject. But this was, these are Donald Trump's true colors. He admires union busters. He admired a billionaire, a fellow wealthy person firing workers for engaging in their fundamental human right to just engage in concerted activity for their mutual aid and benefit.
Right.
He admires Elon Musk for firing people because they decided to speak out.
Now, let me ask you this, because, you know, we've seen Trump's record. In fact, you know, my union, the Teamsters Union, the general president went and spoke at the RNC. And for that and for my disagreeing with that, we're basically on the outs because my fear had been that he was going to normalize what Trump's record was. I now see a lot of my Teamster brothers finally coming around and going, wait a second, the Trump era wasn't great. Is this a good opportunity, I mean, for Kamala Harris to take a look at the Trump years, especially for labor, and the Biden years and go, there's never been clearer distinctions between two ideological goalposts than there are between Trump and the Biden-Harris camp. As the director of advocacy, is this not something that should be on billboards somewhere? Something we should be screaming from mountaintops?
We are doing that now in communities across the country to make clear the contrast between what was the Trump administration and the Biden-Harris administration. We're doing that as much as possible. It's, you know, it's, it, it is so clear given the fact that you, what, you know, this, this Elon Musk interview where he is praising Elon Musk for firing striking workers. You can contrast that with the fact that Joe Biden walked picket lines. For the first time ever, a sitting president went out and walked a picket line with the auto workers. Kamala Harris decided to do a swing through, you know, very union cities when she announced, you know, when she started her campaign just in the last couple of weeks, and picked one of our union brothers, Tim Walz, to be her running mate. He has walked picket lines in Minnesota for nurses. He walks one of the Stellantis picket lines, and he has one of the most, I guess, aggressively pro-worker records as a governor of a state, you know, we've seen in recent years. So she is, it's a difference between night and day between Harris and Trump, Harris Walz versus Trump Vance when it comes to working people's issues. Yeah. And this is not, like you said, one of these elections where you can vote on other issues and ignore the economic issues. If you're a working person, the pocketbook issues, because Donald Trump is bad news for working people's bottom lines.
This isn't one of those elections where they're all the same. No, no, very, very different indeed. And you brought up Tim Walz, who I got to tell you, I'm not sure if they made that guy in a Petri dish, but I don't think there's a more perfect pick to be her vice presidential candidate than that guy. I mean, hits every box that I've been saying Democrats need to check off. The ability to talk to rural voters and maybe move some rural voters into the camp of worker issues, I think is fabulous.
I totally agree. He feels like everybody's Midwestern dad.
He's that guy you want to, I know it's a stupid line, but he's the guy you want to have a beer with or several. So last line of question that I've got for you, because, you know, we're moving quickly towards the convention. I know labor will be front and center in a lot of the discussions, and it's going to be the kind of messaging event that I think is going to be important to compare and contrast these two different styles. In your opinion, in your thoughts, if you're the guy with the magic wand, what are the things, what are the top three things voters should know about Trump? And then also, you know, what and how Harris compares in those worlds.
Okay, so the top three things, well, I'd say Donald Trump effectively two accomplishments while he was president, and that shows what he prioritized. The first accomplishment he had was he cut taxes for the rich. And you know, that was priority number one for him. Priority number two was packing our court system with right-wing judges that have managed to take away lots of our rights, especially in the labor and employment realm. But across the board, the American people have lost rights thanks to his appointments in the judiciary. And then number three, he is a union buster. He has, like you said, he admires companies that will fire workers for speaking out. That's the kind of person and the kind of behavior Donald Trump admires. So he's not going to stick up for working people. Whereas Kamala Harris, and as being part of this Biden administration, they have made a difference left and right when it comes to working people. Pulling us out of the pandemic and the downturn that was happening around the pandemic, the amount of investment, the actual investment in real infrastructure projects, not the infrastructure weeks that Donald Trump would claim were existing and nothing would happen, but in fact, money has been moving. Shovels have been hitting the dirt and jobs have been created thanks to the Biden-Harris administration, putting lots and lots of Americans to work, having some of the lowest unemployment we've seen, sustained unemployment that we've seen in our lifetimes. And the work that Harris in particular did, making recommendations in a White House task force to make sure the entire federal government is looking out for workers every time they do anything, whether they're contracting, dealing with a contractor or putting out grants or awards, think about the impact this will have on working people and make sure you are promoting good jobs when you spend the taxpayer dollar. She has been a critical part of that kind of agenda, and she frankly broke the Senate tie. You know, she was a tie-breaking vote on lots and lots of Senate votes where, you know, we were putting in to place better judges for our judiciary, judges who come from working class backgrounds, who might have represented workers, not just judges who represented the executive suites of big corporations.
Again, the choice never more divided. The posts never further apart, in my view. There seems to be only one choice in this election. But Jody, I appreciate you taking time for us, sharing your knowledge and your passion. Thanks so much.
Thank you. I really appreciate you having me.
Jody Calamine, AFL-CIO's Director of Advocacy. You want to check out their work, AFLCIO.org. You can see all the great things that they're doing. Also follow them on social media. I want to hear your thoughts. Do you see the difference? Or are we still stuck on those divisive issues? I want to hear it. Email me, rick@thericksmithshow.com. Right back. Stick around.
This is News from the Center, WRCE. Local radio for you and your community. It's Civic Media's mission with stations across Wisconsin. Find your favorites at civicmedia.us.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A few clouds in the overnight and some patchy fog forming as well. Light winds in mid-50s expected at sunrise. After the morning patchy fog, we'll have mostly sunny skies. Our winds will remain on the light side, with highs topping out in the middle and upper 70s. It's 63 at our studios.
The Todd Alba Show.
Even Scott Walker and other Republicans are going apoplectic because Trump keeps melting down into these personal attacks. He's just off the rails, Trigby.
You know, Scott may not be the brightest man, but he knows what politics is. Donald Trump is never going to change. Scott, come on the show. We'll talk about it. Todd and I will be nice to you, and I won't make Badger Boy State jokes.
The Todd Alba Show. Weekdays, noon till 2, on your local Civic Media radio station and on the app.
Listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So on Monday, did a piece on why I like Tim Wahl so much, and got a lot of email response from people going, yeah, exactly. He's radically normal, which is, you know, what I've been saying. The guy is like your neighbor, and he's the guy who, you know, like my next door neighbor. You know, I was away. My wife was pregnant with the kids. He came over and shoveled the snow out of the driveway. Nobody asked him to do it, just did it. In fact, we had to figure it out. That's the kind of guy that I want in the political office. Someone who's going to be part of the community, care about their neighbors, do the good stuff that someone like Tim Walz, from what I'm seeing, can do. So the question becomes, and I've been saying this for a very long time, we need to be reaching out to working class voters in a bigger way, especially rural working class voters. That's why I was thrilled to see my friend Roger Kirsten put out a new piece over at barnraising.com or barnraisingmedia.com, asking that very question: can Tim Walz help Democrats win back rural America? Roger, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here, Rick. Always glad to join you for some conversation.
So an extremely important question, because it's been assumed for a very long time that Democrats just gave up on rural America. I mean, you know, Hillary and Obama have both, you know, said some things that can be taken as disparaging to rural America. Does Tim Walz give Democrats an inroad there?
Well, a lot of folks on this call certainly hope so. And I think I would. So this was at the request of the fine folks at Barnraiser, and the website again is barnraisingmedia.com. I listened in on the Rural Americans for Harris call, I guess it was last Tuesday the 6th. And as you know, there have been many of these. There was Black women for Kamala and white women for Kamala and white dudes for Kamala and Black men for Kamala. This is a little bit smaller group. It was a couple thousand people, but it was rural organizers from Kentucky, Georgia, Mississippi, Ohio, a lot of different states, North Carolina, where rural voters would play, and Pennsylvania was represented. a lot of places where rural voters will play an important part in the election. And I would say the theme was show up, don't give up, that there are real opportunities there. There are voters, as you say, who are hurting, who could be receptive to a message about investing in communities, about bringing people together as opposed to dividing people. And they, like you, are very positive on Tim Walz's choice. The story is Governor Walz had agreed to headline this call, and then he got nominated to be vice president, so he couldn't make it. So Peggy Flanagan, who's the lieutenant governor of Minnesota, came in to speak in his place, which she may have to do more than a few times in the next couple of months. And if he's successful, she will become governor of Minnesota and be the first Native American governor in the country's history, I think. So that's an interesting sideline as well.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, but I look at Tim Walz and I look at the fact, and one of the reasons that I was pulling for him is that he does some of the things that, I think Democrats need to do better. And that is, you know, ball up your digits and get in there and mix it up a little bit. You know, when a street fight breaks out, don't be the one that offers to hold their coat, but get in there and fight back. And I think Walz does that in a way that isn't as maybe as combative, but just as you know, strong and willing to fight as anyone else. I think rural voters are attracted to that kind of strength, and talking about it in a, you know, in a way that rural voters like me understand.
Yeah, I think I read a piece today that also, you know, he's got a pretty good occupational background for this. I mean, if you think Fox News is tough or Trump is tough or whatever, you try standing up in front of high school teenagers five days a week for 20 years. And part of his appeal is that he has a way to make his point without being offensive to the audience. He's a little bit self-deprecating. And, you know, he was on his feet. He was a football coach. He was a civics teacher. He understands issues. He understands how to relate and communicate to people. And as I say, the rural organizers who've been advocating for more resources and more attention to these communities are excited that he's a guy who can really help them. Well, one of the things that I think sometimes gets overlooked is the connection between rural communities and manufacturing communities in small cities and towns. You know, in a lot of farm families, somebody's got a job and a paycheck and some health insurance from some place.
Right.
Even while they're trying to make the farm work. And that, I think, became even more true. Those of us with a little gray hair remember the 1980s. There was a farm crisis. A lot of people lost their farms and somebody had to go to work, get a paycheck coming in. Well, when NAFTA and the unrestricted trade with China happened in the 90s and 2000s, then a lot of those jobs went away. Those factories closed. And there were communities in where, in the smaller cities that are in rural areas, there's kind of one plant in town, a plant like Maytag or paper mill. When that plant closes, there's nothing left, and people are really in a tough circumstances. So in 2016, when Donald Trump came on the scene, he was the first presidential nominee of a major party to campaign against free trade. He really found that resonated in rural communities very strongly. They'd seen the job loss, they'd seen the pain. They were hopeful that this would be something new and different. And I think what rural Democrats are excited about as well, that didn't work out so well. He maybe talked a good game, but didn't really bring many solutions. Here's some folks who are listening and perhaps can bring some solutions.
No, and this is what I've given Biden credit for, because, you know, in 2022, we did our working class heroes tour, and we went to places that used to be. You know, places like you've laid out that used to have a factory there that was the anchor of that community, that brought revenue in, that generated, you know, the jobs that farmers may have needed for health insurance and the such. And what's happened to those places since, as you so eloquently laid out, we've lost those jobs. And then, you know, we want to do a tour this year about the places that are going to be the investments that have been made by the Biden administration, and where Harris and Walz can pick this up and move it forward, and why Walz, I think, is the right guy to be the number two there to help steer some of that, having that firsthand experience of seeing those communities go through the pain and the suffering of losing that anchor, and then the problems that come along, and then hopefully having some of those solutions. So I think as a salesman, he could be a real positive for Democrats in reclaiming, like you said, those rural Democrats that left because the factories left.
Yeah, that's what the hope was. And there's a lot of, you may remember what Howard Dean used to call the 50-state strategy. which the Democrats can't be afforded to be absent anywhere. And I heard a lot of echoes of that in speakers on this call. If you think of swing states, well, maybe I'm in a red county in North Carolina or in Pennsylvania or in Michigan. And if I run for something, maybe I don't have that good of a chance of winning. But if there's a candidate there, at least there'll be somebody to turn out. And then votes can go to Harrison Waltz, and we've got a Senate race here, and so on. And I've been looking for another story I'm working on. I've been looking at voting results in some rural Michigan counties. I'm based in northern Michigan. And there's counties where there's no Democratic candidate for prosecutor or sheriff or register of deeds or any of those countywide offices, which are significant offices in terms of people's daily lives. But Democrats feel like they just don't be competitive, so they don't run anywhere. And the message of this call was, hey, we've got a top of the ticket can really speak to some of these voters. Let's get out there. Maybe the 60-40 race will only be 55-45, but that extra 5%, boy, that can really help put some candidates we care about over the top.
Yeah. No, I mean, your statewide candidates, especially here in a place like Pennsylvania, where, Democrats have historically just looked to Philadelphia. If we get a good turnout in Philadelphia, we're going to do okay. Good turnout in Pittsburgh, and forget about the T and the rest of the state. And Republicans have had free reign, at least in my state. So to hear this music to my ears, because something we've been screaming about here on this program for, 19 years now, to get in there and like I said, mix it up a little bit, because Democratic ideas are good ideas, and they're good for urbanites, they're good for rural suburbanites, they're good for American workers, and they need to tell that story better and not shy away from it.
There's that piece of it. I mean, of course, there's James Carville's famous quote about Pennsylvania. You got Pittsburgh and Philadelphia and Appalachia in between. You could say that about Michigan or Ohio or all kinds of states. There's no state that's all cities, not even New York or California. There's a lot of folks in small towns and rural communities that are, they want to be represented too. They want to have their voices heard. And while I certainly think it's true that President Biden's policies and the Inflation Reduction Act have been positive and are leading to reinvestment, you also have to own up to the fact that NAFTA and bringing China into the World Trade Organization, those were Democratic policies. They were bipartisan policies, in fact, but had support from President Clinton and other Democrats, and there was a price to pay for the economic devastation that were caused by those kind of policies. And it's not just showing up, it's also showing up with something better.
Yeah, I'm going to push back a little bit on that, because I don't think those were Democratic policies. NAFTA was certainly not. It was birthed under Reagan, fully negotiated under H.W. Bush. Clinton got in at the end when it was already negotiated. He added some labor and environmental things. This was fully bipartisan. There was only one person in that 92 race who was opposed to it. And as the guy with the big ears who said you're going to have a giant sucking sound, who turned out to be right. What's kind of a little frustrating to me is everyone says these are Democratic principles. They're not. They were bipartisan. This is when we were truly bipartisan. And this is why I'm not a huge fan of bipartisanship.
Well, it was a bipartisan consensus to send jobs overseas, and we don't have to worry too much about manufacturing or economy will cover it in other sectors. And it's intriguing, in fact, to see at times when parties were really at loggerheads, that was the one thing they could agree on, is let's do more free trade.
Yeah.
And that's caused a lot of dislocation in the United States, and many communities are still paying the price. I think you're seeing some recovery now. And I personally am very excited about seeing them and that go into renewable energy and addressing climate at the same time as you're addressing the need for manufacturing and trying to help make sure that states like Michigan, where the auto industry is obviously still vital to our state, get to be part of the new industry and the newest high technology and 21st century jobs. But it's a challenge. And President Biden's tried to step up to that challenge, and Kamala Harris and Tim Walz are going to pick up that banner. We'll see how well they connect with rural and small town voters on these issues.
Yeah, but ultimately, I go back to and I think about, when we did our 22 tour, the people that we met said, look, the reality that rural voters were Democrats, they were Democrats in economic terms. Socially, they were still very conservative, but economically, they bought into a lot of the Democratic ideals. When you had strong unions in rural communities, clearly, you know, strong labor support, strong Democratic support. Does what you're talking about equate to these rural communities rediscovering labor unions and that kind of push? Because these new jobs can come in, but if they don't pay decent wages, they don't have decent benefits, I don't know that you're making lives much better. And I guess the other part is who gets credit for it?
Well, it's an open question. One, what happens, and two, how people perceive what happens. But certainly you're correct. Just because a job is created doesn't mean it's a good job. But that's kind of up to working people in our unions. We got to go out there and organize. The government can push money in, but when the hiring happens and the plan opens and the jobs get there, what kind of jobs will there be? That's a fight that working people have to engage in. And you know, as well as anybody, you don't get anywhere without putting up fight. If they can, companies will pay the lowest wage and have a non-union setting, and that's what they like to do. So working people have to say something different and go out there and win those organizing campaigns.
Yeah.
So that a lot of that remains to be seen. Certainly under this administration, there's a view that union jobs and good paying jobs and jobs with healthcare and retirement security are an important part of how you rebuild the country. And that's a positive, but it's not all up to what the politicians in D.C. decide to do. It's up to what families decide to do in small towns in Pennsylvania and Ohio and Michigan, and how do they react to these new jobs and new opportunities, and is that a broadly shared prosperity or another trickle-down setup where the investors are making a lot of money but the workers don't do very well? That's not predetermined. We're gonna have to fight that one out.
Yeah, and again, for me, it comes from the people who are at the top. And look, Biden has pushed this union promotion of unions like we're supposed to be doing under the NLRA. And I look at someone like Tim Walz, much like your governor, Whitmer, who when they got the keys to the steamroller, they knew how to drive it and they got stuff done. So for me, having Walz on the ticket is someone who I've been calling them get her done Democrats. We need people who are going to go in there and push the ideology and the policies of making people's lives better. And I'm hoping he's the guy who's going to be really behind pushing that.
Yeah, I mean, that's his track record in Minnesota. And he's somebody who ran in a purple district, so he had to appeal across the board. He has a reputation for working across the aisle when he was in Congress, a little bit different when he got to be a governor. But he's somebody who responds to his constituency. When he represented a red purple district, he reached across the aisle and had certain kind of policies. When he's governor of blue state, a little bit different. He had a trifecta, and he certainly used the opportunities he had to push some very positive policies for workers and families. So he can be a good spokesman for that. Yeah. I do think, you know, it's the top of the ticket that matters the most. And Vice President Harris has had a tremendous rollout, one of the most well-executed launches to a campaign I've ever seen. You only get one chance to make a first impression. She's made a good one. So we'll see how that plays out in these communities and whether that continues. It's a compressed campaign, which probably a lot of people are going, thank goodness, it's going to be shorter. We won't have to listen to this for months and months and months. But it's a fight out there. President Trump Republicans aren't going away. They've got something to say on these issues, and they're going to duke it out for support in these communities and in the suburbs and so on. And it's going to be very interesting. It's been a very interesting 6 weeks. And I think it'll be a very interesting what's going to be in the next 12 to 16 weeks as well.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to the debates. Will be very interesting to see. But Roger, I appreciate you taking some time. Great piece. I hope folks will check out barnraisingmedia.com, where you can find Roger Kirsten's piece, Can Tim Walz Help Democrats Win Back Rural America? We'll get links out on social media. I can take a look at that. Roger, appreciate the time, man.
Sure. Thank you, Rick.
I want to hear your thoughts. Is it possible? Could it be possible that Democrats might actually bring back some rural voters, people like me? Can we do that? I think so. Want to hear your thoughts? Email me, rick@therickSmithShow.com. Quick break. Right back. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1936. That was the day that President Franklin Delano Roosevelt signed the Social Security Act into law. The act was a key piece of the president's New Deal, a series of federal programs responding to the ravages of the Great Depression. Social Security would provide an income for retirees and the disabled to ensure that they did not slide into complete destitution. On signing the bill, President Roosevelt, known for delivering memorable speeches, addressed the press. He said, quote, "Today, the hope of many years standing in large part fulfilled. The civilization of the past 100 years, with its startling industrial changes, has tended more and more to make life insecure. Young people have come to wonder what will their lot when they come to old age. The man with a job has wondered how long that job will last. This Social Security measure gives at least some protection to 50 million of our citizens who will reap direct benefits through unemployment compensation, through old age pensions, and through increased services for the protection of children and the prevention of ill health." He went on to say, quote, "The law will flatten out the peaks and valleys of deflation and inflation. It is, in short, a law that will care of human needs and at the same time provide the United States an economic structure of vastly greater soundness." Over the past few decades, politicians have increasingly sounded the alarm that Social Security will not remain viable as the large baby boomer generation retires and draws benefits. Yet despite those who seek to attack Social Security, it remains a bedrock of the social safety net for millions of Americans. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
So on Tuesday, the Teamsters National Black Caucus, they endorsed Kamala Harris and Tim Walz as president and vice president. Now, again, this is the Teamsters National Black Caucus, a segment of the Teamsters who have made this endorsement. It's not the Teamsters as a union. They have failed to endorse to this point. And general consensus among a lot of the people that I know and have and I respect don't believe an endorsement is going to come from the international. And it may. Look, there's a long time still till the election. It may come. It may come at the most strategic time. It may be something that's beneficial. But at this point, the consensus seems to be that no endorsement's coming because, well, the argument is divided. And no endorsement, it really is an endorsement for Trump, given the fact that O'Brien was at the RNC convention saying very, very glowing things about Trump and J.D. Vance. And it's interesting, you know, J.D. Vance was the right-wing love child for about, I don't know, 6 seconds. And now there's a lot of buyer's remorse because evidently there's some photos. There are always photos, aren't there? There's some photos floating around of JD in drag. What is it about conservatives that they do the things that they seem to say they hate? You know, what would make JD Vance dress up in drag? I've never done it. Not that there's anything wrong with it. You want to be a drag, go live your best life, but don't be a hypocrite about it. That's my problem. Don't be a hypocrite. And I think we're seeing a lot of the hypocrisy of the J.D. Vances of the world and the Trumps of the world and you know, this whole MAGA movement. Some good news coming out of Arizona. Their Secretary of State's office has confirmed that the abortion rights thing that, you know, seemed to be real important to folks going to be on the ballot in November there in Arizona. This could be a big driver. And again, one of those states that Democrats do need to win. So this could be a positive. Look, Florida's on the abortion's on the ballot in Florida. So is legalized marijuana. They're saying Florida may actually be in play this election. Florida may actually be in play. Kind of shows how far Trumpism is falling. And I think, understand, you know, I started today's show off talking about the interview that Trump did with Elon Musk, and it's bad. Save yourself the trouble. Just it's all rehash material, just in one long format of rambling and stuttering. But I think people are finally starting to tire a little bit. There's no optimism in Trump's speeches anymore. you know, when he, in 2016, when he burst onto the scene, 2015, 16, he was talking about rebuilding manufacturing. He was talking about rebuilding middle-class lives. He was talking about those communities that have felt left behind. They actually felt heard, that their problems might be addressed by someone like Donald Trump. They weren't, and they never were going to be. There was never a plan. I don't think he had, I believe he never thought he was going to win. So it was just, hey, we're just talking stuff to get attention. Biden, on the other hand, has actually done a lot of really great stuff. And I look at the investments we're making in alternative energy. I just saw a story the other day that said in New Mexico, there's another big solar factory going to go in, some like $950 million investment by this Ebron Solar Company, which is a, you know, again, one of these big Singapore, you know, based chip manufacturer. They're a subsidiary of this Ebang International. And it seems that the chip making folks are going, hey, there's some interest in the U.S. to make solar cells. Maybe we invest in that. Now, this is the second company that is investing in that area. You had another big company that's going to spend, I think it was some over $1 billion was the last number I saw. It's this Singapore-based Maxeon Solar Technologies. They're going to employ about 1,800 people. That's going to create about 1,800 jobs. And then, you know, add all the construction jobs and all the interest in that area. You're now, that's going to be like Solar Central. And it's interesting, you know, as I saw the name of the place, it's Mesa del Sol. And this Mesa del Sol for Breaking Bad fans is where Breaking Bad was filmed. And my mind goes, is it possible that, you know, that someone at these companies were Breaking Bad fans? I don't know, but it is interesting to me that all of this investment is going there. And then you go, wait a second. No, it's not Breaking Bad. As much as I love Breaking Bad, that's not it at all. It's the investment that were made. It's the investments that were made by the Biden administration. It was the investments made by the city of Albuquerque. It was the vision to say, we're going to create this, this area, this region that's going to take on this kind of technology. It's the industrial development area that they created and planned commercial, industrial, residential building around this Albuquerque area, which again is going to create the kind of jobs, the kind of future that we want to pass along to our kids and our grandkids. I think it's great. Here's my problem, though, and I'm sure you're going to know where I'm going to go with this. You got two Singapore companies coming in doing what we should be doing for ourselves here at home. Because, you know, it seems like American manufacturers still have China on their mind. And it seems like, you know, a political party in this country, while all there's a lot of talk about how much we need to take on China, still kind of in that world. This is where, as a kid growing up in the 70s, when manufacturing in the U.S. was king, and we were the global leader in manufacturing, I'd love to see us be that again. I'd love to see those jobs that are being created in new technologies and in visionary industries incubate, grow, and prosper right here for American workers. And not because, you know, I'm hyper patriotic, I am, but because those jobs are going to create opportunities for families to lead a better life. Those jobs could come with good wages, good benefits, health, retirement security, safe working conditions, opportunities, could pay taxes into the local school base so we have better schools, could demand we need better health care. There's so much positivity that could come out of a growing, massive industrial base. We just have to be smart enough to go, yeah, that's what we want. We just have to be smart enough to go, yes, please, more. Can we do more of this? And it's clear that Donald Trump doesn't have this at heart. It's clear that Kamala Harris and Tim Walz, it's clear that they do. Why? Because they're picking up the mantle from Joe Biden. And as I said at the beginning, Joe Biden, I got to tell you, history is going to smile on Joseph Biden. Just my thoughts. I want to hear yours. Email me, Rick at the RickSmithShow.com. Missing any portion of the program? Grab the podcast. Wherever you get your favorite podcast, you'll find ours. Also, check Free Speech TV, freespeech.org, the website, for all of our video contents. And as always, thanks so much for being here. We'll see you back here next time.
You've been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Email Rick. Rick at the Rick Smith Show.com.
This is News from the Center, 1450 AM WRCE and 107.7 FM W299 CD Richland Center. And always on this.